Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Fires all over Utah. Evacuations in Saratoga Springs. Homes burned in San Pete County. Fire near Leeds in southern Utah. Now a fire between Price and Duchesne. This is one of the worst fire seasons in recent memory. It continues in Utah. And we'll get the latest news this morning from Salt Lake Tribune reporter Simmer Neugebauer and from UPR's own Chris Holmes. Talk with a resident affected by the fire, Joe Bailey, who was evacuated from his Eagle Mountain home. We'll also talk with BLM Utah Fire Manager Sheldon Wimmer. We'll ask him what we can do to reduce the risk of fire in this current very dangerous conditions. And we'll ask you what you think can and should be done. Later in the program, since today's Election Day, we'll turn our attention to the primaries and talk with the chairman of the Democratic and Constitution parties and other officials. That's coming up following the news.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Here's the headline in the Salt Lake Tribune this morning. Wall of fire devastates. It's talking about the Wood Hollow Fire in San Pete County. More than 1,000 people evacuated, some 15 homes destroyed, and that fire is still not fully contained. Of course, we heard about the dump fire in Utah County. Many were evacuated there. Quail fire in southern Utah. The newly started church camp fire in Carbon County. These on the heels of other fires. This is a fire season that started early and is continuing with no end in sight, one of the worst in recent memory. We're going to talk about it again today on Access Utah. Later in the program, Joe Bailey, an Eagle Mountain resident who was evacuated, the recent fire there. And we'll talk with BLM Utah Fire Manager Sheldon Wimmer. We'll be asking you what you think we can do to prevent fires, what should be done, what has been your experience this year with fire, and what can we do to help those affected. Some of the questions we'll be asking you, and the number to call in is 1-800-826-1495. Later in the program, since this is primary day, we'll have some party officials on and elections officials and talk about getting out the vote on this primary day. We begin getting the latest with our own UPR reporter, Chris Holmes, reporting in from Cedar City. Chris, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
I appreciate you taking time. And Salt Lake Tribune reporter, part of the team of reporters covering this, Simran Neugebauer. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with you, Simran. The wall of fire devastates. The pictures have been pretty scary, and a lot of evacuations this year. Let's get the latest from that Wood Hollow fire. This has destroyed some homes, has it not?
It has, and most recently there was some information about an elevated number of some homes being destroyed. Since then, Incident Command has said there was a miscommunication in their gathering efforts as far as getting information. Originally, they had reported about anywhere from 25 to 30 homes that were, or structures, I should say, about 10 or 12 of those actually being homes, some full-time residences. Others were just summer homes for people. Anyway, we're still trying to get a more accurate number. There was a recent number this morning that was given out, but they're verifying and planning and actually going out to the site today to reassess and to have search and rescue lead teams and people out to assess the damage of exactly how much has been devastated by this massive fire.
Massive fire, and this is in what part of San Pete County? I'm reading near Fairview.
Yeah, this is near Fairview. For those not familiar kind of with the geography, this is in central Utah, and it's the northern part of San Pete County, kind of where the county line is to close to Utah County, the northeast part of San Pete County, and kind of up where you turn off to go up into Price Canyon, just south of that. Right now, the fire size is slated about 38,928 acres. The cause is human cause. It's still under investigation, however, and the fire started about a mile south of Fountain Green, and it's just rapidly spread. Winds have been going like crazy the last few days, and hopefully Mother Nature will give firefighters a little bit of a break, and that's kind of what they're predicting with the weather. I know some storm fronts are moving in, they've predicted, and even though lightning might come with those, the new change in pressure and everything should cause some of these winds to subside a little bit, and firefighters are hoping to get a better handle on the fire, which is only 15% contained as of this morning.
Also in this morning's Tribune, officials say they don't know the cause of the Wood Hollow blaze, but copper thieves may have caused a short circuit by compromising transmission equipment.
That's correct. I've actually been able to talk to some residents in the area who saw roughly the area where the fire started. And up in that area is kind of known as, Power Line Row or whatever, and there's a bunch of power lines that just go up the side of the mountain adjacent to a dirt road, and that's where they believe part of the fire started, off a spark from a power line because it wasn't properly insulated, is according to Rocky Mountain Power. And so they believe because of a recent copper theft that area wasn't properly insulated and might have caused some sparking, which possibly led to fire. But this is also, they said, preliminary investigation, and there could be other scenarios that they're looking into as far as how the fire started. This is just one of many. I just want to stress that. This is not the actual cause right now. This is preliminary.
And more than 1,000 people evacuated.
Yes, that's correct. There have been many evacuations throughout the area in Indianola. A lot of homes west of US 89, as well as east of them, in various subdivisions and neighborhoods. I think something that's been a very impressive thing is when I first came down here to report on this back on Sunday night, when I went to the Red Cross shelter, no one was there. And when I checked up on Monday morning to see if anyone came for breakfast, no one was there still. And in reporting, I found that between LDS church wards and just friends or family in the area, everyone's found somebody to stay with. So the Red Cross hasn't had to work as, be as burdened with people coming into a shelter. They have a capacity for about 500, but they haven't had to worry about that so far because of the tight-knit community and people opening their homes and their hearts to those in the area. And I think that's kind of a statement about the area, Santee County here, and just what residents are willing to do for those who have obviously suffered some pretty tragic losses, some completely lost their homes.
Let's turn to Chris Holmes. You've been reporting for us on the Quail Fire near Leeds. I don't know whether this burned any structures.
A couple of buildings, which are being described as sheds, were destroyed with the fire. There were several homes that were very close to the flames, and fortunately, quick action on the part of interagency firefighters spared those homes.
And is that fire contained now?
The fire is 100% contained. It burned just over 1,700 acres. 60 homes were evacuated at one point in time on Saturday, and over 600 homes were without power because of power lines that were destroyed in the fire. Power has since been restored to those homes as well.
Were there any evacuations for this fire?
There were evacuations on Saturday, yes, when the fire initially started. 60 homes were evacuated.
And what's the people you've been talking to, are they talking about this as obviously it's a very bad fire season. I've been describing it as one of the worst in recent memory. That's my recent memory. Some of the people I've talked to. I don't know where this fits in with people you talk to.
The people I'm talking to say they've never seen it worse. I've described it in the report you just heard as almost a perfect storm type scenario when it comes to wildfires. Of course, the most notable fire in southern Utah in the season so far was the White Rock Fire on the border of Utah and Nevada, which claimed the lives of two heavy air tanker pilots back on June 3rd. The investigation continues into that crash. Most recently, we've had this Quail Fire, and in a preemptive move, the Forest Service has closed a campground and a certain section of the Dixie National Forest down here to campers because of what they fear could happen. Only a single road going into the area. They're afraid that people might go in there, a fire might begin, and they'd be trapped behind the lines. And so in a preemptive move, they've closed the campground until further notice.
I imagine restrictions all over the place. Simran Neugebauer, in the Tribune, you write, Salt Lake area, other areas are being proactive as well with restrictions on fireworks, on fires of any kind?
Yes, that's correct. The governor was here visiting yesterday. He went as far to say is they're working on a statewide ban of any fireworks used on any unincorporated areas as far as individual cities. Various cities, if you just go to their your individual city's websites, a lot of them have posted online their fire restrictions. So there isn't much excuse for not knowing about fire restrictions this season. It's pretty clear, especially if you're a resident. It's about as simple as don't light any fireworks outside of your city limits is essentially what it comes down to. And even if you're in your city limits, you need to check with your city where those safe areas to light off fireworks are, so we don't have any more problems. I just wanted to quickly add there, I just got some breaking news about some evacuations that have been lifted for the east side of Highway or U.S. 89 and the Fairview Ranchos subdivision area. So, again, that's the evacuations that were previously put in place. San Pete County Sheriff is saying that through Twitter that those evacuations have been lifted for those on the east side of Highway 89 and the Fairview Ranchos. However, they are also urging and letting people know residents of those areas are still advised to keep everything packed in an event of a further evacuation.
And I'll give a mention to you're doing tweets on you're calling yourself Sim City.
That's
and,
correct.
Doing tweets at the Tribune website, so you can see the latest from Simran Neugebauer, and that tweet just went out that he mentioned there. So the officials you're talking to, maybe start with this with Chris Holmes. I don't know. Is there a level of frustration here that a lot of these fires seem to be human caused? There's target shooting and a lot of human caused fires in this very bad season.
There is very much a level of frustration. The Quail Fire was evidently started by a gentleman burning cheatgrass on his own property to knock back the weeds. And, of course, things got out of hand. You remember it was a very windy weekend, absolutely the wrong time to embark upon that type of endeavor. Statewide red flag warnings in place. Nonetheless, we've got citizens doing something like that. In the case of the campground closure, it's interesting that one of the things that prompted officials to go ahead with that closure was that despite the statewide red flag warnings, they've come across a handful of abandoned campfires still smoldering, not put out properly. And so they simply decided to close that entire area to any more camping until further notice.
Hmm. Simran Neugebauer, can you give us an update on the church campfire? This is burning somewhere between Price and Duchesne?
Yeah, that's correct. Haven't been following that one as closely, but obviously covering wildfires, kind of keeping an eye out for everything. So the latest update I can give you that I've seen on that one is it's about 1,000 acres have been charred in that one so far, as well as it's about, I think they said it's a 0% containment still. The update that they had earlier today, it's about 22 miles south of Duchesne. It's in the canyon called the Argyle Canyon. And the interesting thing about this this fire here, it's threatened as well as burned some structures in that area. A lot of them cabins and some historic cabins in that area. But the very interesting thing here is they actually have a commercial size plane, a DC-10, and this this commercial plane basically is outfitted to carry about 11,000 gallons of water compared or retardant compared to air tankers that normally carry about 2,200 gallons, and it actually has a lead plane that flies in front of it to help direct it through areas, and it's fueled and reloaded with water out of Boise, so it's quite the undertaking as far as the resources that are being brought in to capture these fires. And And it's only June. I think that's the biggest exclamation point on this whole thing is it's only June. And yesterday, when the governor came in and talked to the media, we were told there's been more than 402 fires in 2012, ground fires in cities and stuff, as well as wildland fires included. And 90% of those are human caused. So there's definitely a large amount that we can improve on. We still haven't got into the real dry season yet. So that's the biggest concern right now is limiting the human-caused fires because those are the most preventable ones, and we're about 90% with those.
Still a lot of danger out there. We have been getting updates from Simon Neugebauer from the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
The Salt Lake Tribune website, of course. Look for those tweets under the Sim City name. Our own Chris Holmes has been with us as well. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Tom.
And we've been hearing reports from Chris Holmes. I'm sure we'll continue to do so on the fires in southern Utah. Thanks so much. Following a brief break, we're going to get the experience of an Eagle Mountain resident. That's Joe Bailey. And he was evacuated with that dump fire. We'll get to his experience. We'll also be talking with Sheldon Wimmer from the BLM, a fire official, and talk about, from that perspective, later in the hour, we'll talk about primary day. It's election day. Sort out the nominations for various party races. That's coming up in the last segment. All that following a brief break.
Hi, this is Blair Larson, host of Fresh Folk. On the show this week, I feature the story songs from the James Lowe Western Front and the new live album from fingerstyle guitarist Richard Gilowitz. I'll also play tracks from new releases by Beth Cahill, Chatham Street, and the Sultans of String, among other talented artists. Tune in this Saturday at 8 p.m. to Fresh Folk on Utah Public Radio.
Last week, things were a lot more exciting, I'm sure, for Joe Bailey than he wanted. He was among the evacuees, Eagle Mountain resident. The dump fire, of course, it was concerned, is 100% contained now, but we all saw the pictures, and that must have been quite an experience. We'll have him talk about it. Joe Bailey, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
We appreciate you taking some time. So I guess, when did you first notice that there was a problem? When did you first notice the fire?
You know, I was actually at work when it broke out. My wife called me about 10 minutes to 10 in the morning. She mentioned that there were sirens going around the neighborhood with emergency personnel with megaphones telling everybody to evacuate, get out of their homes. My wife called and said, well, what do I take? And I gave her some information. I said, well, go ahead and take the 72-hour kits, the special documents, and get out of there. She didn't have a car, so she was contacting neighbors to see if anyone could get her a ride. Luckily, they had plenty of time to get out of the neighborhood. There were some residents in Saratoga Springs that were only given 30 seconds to get out of their home.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And when you think about people who need life-saving medications or other things, it's not a lot of time to prepare and to grab those things. So I actually ended up going out to the area. I left work, went out to the area, gave my wife the car because she had a hard time getting a ride out of the area. And then I went around and I knocked on doors letting people know, hey, have you heard about the evacuation? It was really a chaotic experience because people could not get out with phone calls. There were so many people trying to call at the same time that there was the phones just basically shut down. You couldn't get through to anybody. You tried to text somebody, it would take several hours to get that text to them. It was very hard to communicate, and the air out there there was ash all through the air. When we knocked on the doors, there was just a big yellow haze to the air. So it was very hard to breathe. My wife had lungs that were burning from the smoke that was in the air, so I had to take her to get some emergency attention to check on her lungs and to check on her chest. But it was really an eye-opening experience of what to do in an emergency situation. But we were able to get out of there. We spent some time at Westlake High School, which was the evacuation center. Yes, we were able to get out of the area, and luckily we had plenty of time to do so.
And I imagine you're worried the fire might jump the lines, it might burn your home.
Yes, absolutely. It was really close. You could see smoke all over the place. It was hard to get any information. All of the information was going out via Facebook and Twitter. So you had to keep track of that because it was really difficult, as I said, to get through on telephone lines. Luckily, we did have some ham radios that we were using to communicate with each other, make sure that everybody was out of the area. But we spent a lot of time in the evacuation center just waiting for information.
So communication was difficult.
It was,
yeah,
definitely.
What would, having gone through this, what are there things you're going to do differently?
Yeah, we'll definitely have a plan of what we're going to take out of our homes. I was talking to other neighbors in the area. Some of their kids were grabbing salt and cereal boxes. They just really didn't know what to take out of their homes. So I think it was a good experience, especially if you have life-saving medications or stuff that you absolutely need for survival, to have it in a central location and to be able to grab it if you only have 30 seconds or if you only have a minute's notice to get out of there. I think that's the main thing we learned from the situation is having our family prepared to be able to leave at a moment's notice.
Governor Herbert is calling for the legislature and other officials to look into further restrictions on target shooting. Of course, it's been pinpointed as the cause of this fire. Is that something you would support?
I probably would. We do have a lot of target shooters out there. Right next to Eagle Mountain and Saratoga Springs are kind of right at the end of any communities that live out there, so there's plenty of target shooting that takes place there. We actually have a lot of fires in the area that also start out at Camp Williams. Camp Williams is not too far away, so we get a lot of fires in the area, so it's not uncommon, but yes, especially in these dry conditions, there probably does need to be something looked at to see if we can improve the laws to make sure that things like this don't happen again. I mean, I heard the individual that was on the program before. We were told as well that there had been, at the time on Friday, 400 fires that had started, and 380 of those had been human-caused up to that point. So there's definitely a lot of those fires are caused by humans, and we're just at the beginning of fire season this year.
Does this, having gone through this experience, that ratchet up your feeling of, I don't know, frustration that so many are human-caused, or urgency about this?
I think an education effort would be good to come about. I don't think people realize that there's such a danger with target shooting or with other ways that fires, whether it's people leaving their fires in campfires, not all the way out, or whatever the case may be. I think there could be better education efforts for our community in terms of how we prevent those, and then if they are caused, what we can do as a community to better prepare our residents to get out of the area.
On this part of the program, obviously we're talking about the fires, fires all over Utah, and maybe a little relief in sight for some areas of Utah with a change in the weather, but it's still a very dangerous fire season. Joe Bailey, an Eagle Mountain resident, was evacuated with his wife. They're now, of course, back in their homes, but a very frightening experience. Over 1,000 people evacuated in San Pete County, and some of them are being allowed to go home today, others not. And you're welcome to join this conversation. We're asking you, what can we do to prevent these fires? What should we do? What can we do to help those affected? And what has your experience been with the fires this season? 1-800-826-1495. The number toll-free, 1-800-826-1495. Or an email to us at upraccess@gmail.com. upraccess@gmail.com. And we bring in now, along with Mr. Bailey, Sheldon Wimmer, who's BLM Utah Fire Manager. Sheldon Wimmer, welcome back to the program.
Hi, glad to be on again.
And we're talking about this again. We had Sheldon Wimmer on with us a couple of weeks ago. Just an indication of how bad a fire season. I don't know. You've had a lot of experience in this area. Where do you fit this in? Is this an especially bad year?
Well, what's happened is because of the moisture that we didn't get this last winter, and we've ended up with our larger fuel types that are very dry, which is the pinyon juniper type. 6 inches or bigger is what we call our 1,000-hour fuels. And so anytime you get a start, it seems like it carries right into those larger fuels, and they're difficult to suppress. Fine fuels, we have the carryover from last year, of course, from all the moisture. And then we didn't get a lot of extra fine fuel this year because we didn't have a lot of rain in April and the May type rain. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those things where we have those big fires take off with it, and then the wind on it has really made a difference. The Wood Hollow fire down in central Utah, I was down there Sunday afternoon watching that go through those communities, and the fire behavior there is extremely erratic, and with the winds, it was something you'd see out of Southern California, not central Utah.
Hmm. Well, just because of the high incidence of fuels and the winds that are whipping these fires?
That's it. That's combination with low humidities and real dry fuels, as well as the winds going on, pushing them. The other issue is, it is true, we have had an awful lot of human starts this year, and we're trying to get the prevention message out. We do have restrictions in place statewide for fireworks on all public lands and state lands, and we have restrictions in place, what some people call stage one restrictions, which is you've got to smoke in your vehicle, you have to keep your campfire in a regular camp fire ring, and you have to be careful with any kind of pyrotechnic. The shooting prohibition has come on in some parts of the state because of the shooting full metal jacket ammunition, which causes sparks and can light up this fine fuel. Mm. One of the big problems around the west side of Utah Lake is that there is an ordinance that closes most of the county to target shooting, but that side of the county is open.
Mm. Joe Bailey, have you had any interaction with the firefighters?
We did somewhat. They came and explained to us what was going on, let us know about the evacuations. They also escorted certain individuals to their homes to get any life-saving medications or other important items that they needed. So we did have some communication there. There was also somebody from the fire department that had a map showing individuals at the evacuation center where the fire was, what direction it was headed, and just trying to keep people updated with the situation.
Mm. Let's bring in a caller. We have with us John in Parowan. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. We have an always ongoing problem with the assessed cost of fighting and putting out fires. Up to this point, we are excluding something which we all value. When a home is built, we normally install trees, whether they're native trees or imported European trees or what have you. We don't want to lose those trees. And when we lose tens or hundreds or thousands of beautiful juniper or pinyon or spruce or whatever trees that are burned, I think it's only fair, and it has to be, that we include the cost of replanting those large trees which give us shade in the summer on hot days, which give us something that we might want to look at and enjoy. Not everybody's going to like the looks of pinyon or juniper or spruce or willow or cottonwood or what have you, but when they go to get another one that was that big, or tens or hundreds or thousands of them, we need to evaluate that as a an authentic, an actual portion of the cost of what that fire did in the way of damage. Not just the police, the firefighters, the chemicals, the traffic control, evacuation orders, any of that. It's got to be included. We have to do that. Mm-hmm. It's unfair. People build houses a lot of times because they want to be by those trees, and they might not in their lifetime ever see them again. And the cost of implanting those should be assessed against these vicious people, these reckless, careless people that couldn't care less. All they're going to do is what they want to do, whether it's fireworks, illicit target, campfire, or whatever other cause. They need to be held accountable on that behalf, too. We can regrow grasses and other things that people sometimes like, but we cannot easily regrow trees that take 50 or 100 or more years to grow. That is my comment, and let's not ever forget that.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for your time, very much for your time, and you all have a good day.
Okay, thank you, John. Appreciate that. Response, Mr. Wimmer? This is, costs are sometimes... We've got Mr. Wimmer back. I dropped him accidentally. Sorry about that. So I'm not sure if you were able to hear that, Sheldon Wimmer, the comment.
No, what was the question?
He was concerned about the costs of replanting trees. That's very valuable to people. That's why they live in some of the areas. They grow these trees. And if it's human cause, that should be assessed as part of the cost of the fire and perhaps try to recoup that from the people who caused the fire.
That's absolutely correct. When we do a trespass action, what they call a trespass action against someone that started a fire like that, included in the case from the U.S. Attorney's Office are included in that are the rehab costs to reseed or replant vegetation. Sometimes we do trees. You're in a very xerophytic or desert type ecosystem there, so the first thing I'm sure they'll try to do some kind of vegetation rehab with seeding to stabilize that watershed. There could be flooding, mudslides when you hit. It's got heavy rains out there, but there is an effort to recoup those costs.
Let me turn back to Joe Bailey at Eagle Mountain. One of the questions I'm throwing out to our listeners, and I'm sure you have a perspective on this, having gone through an evacuation with the dump fire, what can people do to help? You went door to door and helped your neighbors get out. What can people best do to help their neighbors in these situations?
I think there's several things people can do, whether it's making sure that their neighbors know if you're knocking on the door. I know some neighborhoods in our area had what they call block captains that were in charge of their complete block, so everybody on their street, and they would go and knock on the doors, make sure everyone was accounted for. Being at the first emergency that many of us had gone through, a lot of it did not go perfect. People were just quickly worrying about their family, in some cases just getting their family out, not worrying. Even some of the block captains were doing that, so I think it was a real eye-opening experience that we definitely need to be better prepared. We definitely need to have a plan in place for getting our family out, and if the area is still safe, being able to make sure that that the people in the community are accounted for. Because there's some people in the area that don't have a car, single mothers or older people that need help getting out of the area, and it's important to have somewhat of a plan to know how you can do that, or at least to let the emergency personnel know about them so they can help them get out of the area.
And Sheldon Wimmer, from the perspective of a firefighter, what would your advice to people be to be prepared? What can you do?
Well, one of the things that's happened in the state of Utah is they do have through the communities and cities and through a lot of churches activities, they do have block plans and block leaders that can help get that people out. The other thing people need to remember is they need to have that, FEMA recommends, that 72-hour kit, something there that can sustain them for 72 hours. If they have children, put it in a little backpack, put it in a closet. They can throw it on real easily, put it in a car, and clear the area. One of the things about the fire down the dump fire that people say, well, the fire got really close to the homes, but we didn't lose any homes, so did we really need to evacuate the people? Well, the answer is yes, from the standpoint that when one of these wildfires takes place, you can end up in a situation where the houses become the fuel. They become what's going to burn, and then they'll leapfrog from house to house, and then that's where the real danger takes place. And that's what we saw in some of the other fires in the state where we lost structures, is that one or two homes start, then it's real difficult for a fire department or anyone to stop that with the winds that we've had on it. So they need to be prepared with their own 72-hour kit, and they need to follow the instructions and go to one of those centers where they'll certainly be taken care of.
Hmm. And finally, Sheldon Wimmer, what would your advice to people be, especially with so many human-caused fires this time around? I guess extreme caution from everybody?
If I could just beg everyone to be careful with fire, do not leave a campfire at all. Make sure when you leave, it is cold, dead out. You can put your hand down on that campfire and get it dirty. Make sure that there isn't any heat left in it. Be careful with matches in the, people smoke, they'll throw a match out, they don't even think about it or something like that. A lot of times that's a big problem. And just be cautious with the fireworks this year. Make sure you keep them in a place that's not going to cause a fire on your house, in the neighborhood, or in the wildlands. And so they're closed for wildland use, so no one should be out with fireworks on public lands. Very, very cautious with those things.
And Joe Bailey, you're back home. Your neighbors are back home. What's the scene there in Eagle Mountain nowadays?
It's great. The fire is 100% contained. There's no issues at this point. I think they did a great job of keeping that area safe. I know they had an ammunition area or ammunition plant right by the fire, and if you look up on the mountain, the whole area around it is burned, but that ammunition plant was not burned. I think they just did a great job of making sure that the area was safe and secure, and it was a good experience to learn from.
Joe Bailey, Eagle Mountain resident, he, along with his wife and neighbors, were evacuated in the dump fire. Thanks so much. Appreciate you taking some time for us.
Thank you. You have a good day.
And we've been talking with Sheldon Wimmer, who is Utah fire manager for the BLM. Thanks so much.
You bet, sir.
And appreciate your work and the fellow firefighters there. A good place to go for information is utahfireinfo.gov, utahfireinfo.gov. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to switch gears and talk about Election Day. This is primary day, and several nominations will be settled today. We're urging you to get out and vote. Polls open, I believe, until 8 o'clock in most locations, and we'll be talking with Jim DeBacchus, Utah Democratic Party Chair, and with Mark Thomas, Deputy Chief of Staff to the Lieutenant Governor and Director of Elections. We may also be joined by Kirk Pearson from the Utah Constitution Party, and that is coming up following this break.
Warm summer evenings have arrived, and it's time to head outdoors for parties on the patio. And we've got the perfect soundtrack for your gathering. Jamaican reggae, Congolese soukous, and Caribbean zouk for dancing or just hanging out. I'm Dan Storper.
And I'm Rosalie Howard. Join us for Summer Party, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Friday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
It's Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We conclude the program now by focusing on primary day. Today is an election day, and we're urging everyone to get out and vote. We have several nomination races in the Republican Party. Democratic Party, Constitution Party has their race for governor that's going to be narrowed down. And we turn next to an elections official. We bring in Mark Thomas, who is Director of Elections and Deputy Chief of Staff to Lieutenant Governor. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And Jim DeBacchus returns to the program, Utah Democratic State Chair. Thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks so much. Let's turn first to Mark Thomas. Everything's in place, and I'm not sure if you have an estimation on how many you think are going to turn out today?
Well, everything's in place. Polls opened at 7 o'clock this morning, and so far statewide we're getting some good reports on everything going smoothly. Haven't heard of any issues anywhere. But being election day, they do pop up here and there, so we'll obviously work on those as they come up. However, it's a beautiful day, and I do believe that we are anticipating some pretty good turnout today. We have some really good races that are on the ballot this primary election, and I anticipate between 20 and 25% turnout, which may not sound like a whole lot, but compared to other primary elections, that's at least double what we've seen in the past.
What do you expect to be driving that? Is it the presidential election, the some of the other races?
Well, certainly the presidential election. This would be the first election Utah's ever had where we've had a statewide primary and a presidential primary on the same ballot. So that is new, and there are those folks who like to go out and vote for Mitt Romney, and they make him feel good, I guess. And there are some other races though that are really just as important for those folks here in Utah. I mean, you have the congressional race up in northern Utah for the Democratic Party. You obviously the U.S. Senate race and the auditor and the treasurer or the auditor and the attorney general race are some big races. So yeah, there's some big races out there that will affect Utahns. And they should be getting out there to vote.
And we bring in Kirk Pearson from the Utah Constitution Party. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Let's go first to Jim DeBacchus. What are you expecting in the Democratic primary? The marquee race, I guess, on your side is the first congressional district, but there are many legislative races as well.
Yeah, we've got the first congressional district race, two fine candidates who work very hard. One of them more than likely to upset the long-standing congressman up there, Rob Bishop. So it'll either be Ryan Colmby or Donna McAleer, both of them superb candidates, and we're expecting a pretty good turnout up in the first district. Down in the south part of the valley, a 20-year serving veteran of the legislature has been challenged by a challenger. That would be Neil Hendrickson against Liz Muniz. And then there's this interesting Senate race up in the Cottonwood area. It's an open seat where Karen Morgan was, where Ty McCartney and Josie Valdez will be fighting it out. So there's reasons for Democrats to turn out to the polls today.
Very good. And Kirk Pearson, representing the Utah Constitution Party, you're state chair, I think?
Yes.
Also one of the candidates for governor.
Correct. Yeah.
Against Brandon Ney. So you'll be on the ballot. Are you expecting a good turnout today for Constitution Party?
Yeah, I think we've had quite a few people calling and checking and finding information out. A lot of people excited about it. This is the first time we've had a primary in Utah.
Mm-hmm. Is that a sign of growth in your party?
Yeah, it's a sign of the growth and the more more people that are getting into the race and getting involved in the party.
Does your party have an open primary? Anybody can come in and do you have to register as Constitution Party or you just come in and vote?
No, it's an open primary, so anyone can vote in it.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. DeBacchus, Democrats have an open primary, right? You can come in.
Yeah, there's only one party in the state that's completely closed off, and it's the same party that closes off their caucuses. It's the same party that introduced 477, which is made it harder for the public to get things off. The Republican Party closes their conventions, they close their neighborhood caucuses, they close their voting. The party of a few that like to control a lot, and it doesn't surprise me that in order to vote in the Republican caucus, you got to go in, have to put up your arm, you got to give them some blood and swear that you're a Republican, and then they will consent to let you vote. It's not very American, frankly.
We did put a call into Thomas Wright, the state Republican chair. We're not successful in getting him on the program, but we did put in that call. Let's bring in now Ken Verdoya from KUED and involved with an effort called Vote Utah. Ken Verdoya, welcome to the program.
Good morning, and it's a delight to parachute gently into the discussion on the heels of my friend Jim DeBacchus.
I can't help you.
So tell us about Vote Utah. It's an effort to get people out to vote.
Well, yeah, and it's a very unique initiative among Utah's public broadcasters, both television and radio.
Sounds like, Mr. Verdoya, it sounds like we have some problems with your phone there. I don't know.
Well, I am on a cell phone. Let me further out the window of my car and see if I can avoid the bug and maintain the connection with you at the same time. Is that a little bit better?
That's sounding better, yes. Go ahead.
Oh, good. Good, good. The one emphasis that I was making is that Vote Utah is a unique collaboration of 10 Utah public broadcasters, 3 on the television side, 7 on the radio side, to pool resources to provide voter information for the remainder of the 2012 election year. Our centerpiece is the Vote Utah website, and that's one word, voteutah.org. Not to be confused with the great state election website of voteutah.gov. So it's voteutah.org for voter information and for information on upcoming debates.
All very valuable information. We've been seeing those spots. And have you seen results? I don't know if you've measured whether this is having an effect in increased participation this year round.
Well, what we have seen is a slow evolution of public interest. This is a very interesting year politically for Utah, in that so much of the political coverage to date has been geared towards the presidential candidacy of Mitt Romney and its cause and effect relationship with candidacies in Utah. So we've seen interest go in the presidential components of our website far more than any of the other local the congressional website components, the United States Senate, and the race for governor. Those are all in their infancy in terms of voter interest. But because of the candidacy of Mitt Romney, we expect to see kind of a different makeup of voter turnout and participation in this election year.
Let me turn to Mr. Thomas again, Utah elections head. If you want to vote in the presidential primary, of course, this is a Republican primary. Is that closed as well? You have to register Republican today to vote for Mitt Romney or one of his opponents?
It is. It is a closed primary. The thing to keep in mind, though, is that it is too late to switch parties. You can, though, if you are unaffiliated, you can affiliate with the Republican Party at the polls and vote that Republican Party ballot. But if you are, as of today, registered a Democrat, constitutional, libertarian, any of the other parties, you cannot switch on Election Day.
Hmm. And that's where a lot of the action is happening, is it not? The Republican Party, you have a very hotly contested attorney general's race, auditor's race, which has been heating up, the Senate race, of course, presidential primary. So you can't switch parties, but if you're unaffiliated, you can go in today and register Republican and vote.
That's correct. And there's some big parties on big races on both sides of the aisle. And man, with the resources that our office provides on being able to find your polling location and sample ballot and the resources that it sounds like the media community is providing, come on, there's no excuse. Let's get out there and vote, and great races on the ballot today.
Mm-hmm. What else, Mr. DeBacchus? There was a recent editorial in the Salt Lake Tribune. A vote recently in the legislature's Government Operations Interim Committee to close down the same day, the primary day registration option. And so I think it's 30 days or something you'd have to register as Republican in this case, since they're the ones who have the closed primary. If this passes the full legislature, I wonder what your reaction to that is.
Well, the Republican Party has it as a national goal. It's particularly raised its ugly head in Florida, but also here in Utah to some extent, to try to stifle the vote. Republicans, for whatever calculation, have decided that people deciding at the last moment, or people that don't have a lot of money, or people where ID is a bigger issue than other places, although it's not been shown anywhere in the country that there's any kind of serious voting fraud, they continually and continuously, and some in the Utah legislature, try to make the barriers to voting as high as possible, feeling it gives them a partisan advantage. Who really could be opposed to same-day voting, where people go in, they show their ID, they vote, they participate in democracy, they make that decision then? But as you mentioned, the Republicans feel as it gives them some kind of advantage to not allow that kind of voting, and it's too bad. When you look at the participation in Utah, which in 1980 was fourth in the country, and now we're ranked around 47th, one of the major reasons is that the Republicans and their redistricting and their ability to carve out these districts has created such low possibility of a contested race that people just figure, why should I vote? There's no real reason. One of the reasons to get out and vote and to vote Democrat today is to try to send a message that an overwhelming majority of the legislature, a veto-proof majority and a governor and an attorney general and all the rest of one party is not good for democracy.
Kirk Pearson, I wonder what, I'm curious about the goals of Constitution Party in terms of growing your party. It's my impression the Constitution Party in Utah, at least, is probably the most well-established, apart from the Democratic and Republican parties. Still relatively small, but this is a sign of growth that you have a primary. What are your goals in terms of growth?
Well, we in the past have kind of done more of a shotgun approach where we've had a lot of candidates run, between 50 and 60, and each candidate, the funding hasn't been there for each candidate to go out and run a legitimate campaign. So this year what we're going to focus on, we've had a few candidates elected in Utah in county commission seats and some other local races, and we expect to pick up a couple more this election. But we are going to focus some real effort into two state House seats. And once we win those two seats this election, at least one of them we plan on winning, then we think that'll kind of show people that, we can win elections. And I agree a lot with what Jim has said, too, that the Republicans have disenfranchised so many people. They're upset with the direction the Republican Party has gone, and so they unaffiliate. But then, they have to reaffiliate to vote, and some of them are to the point where I'm sick of this. I'm not going to register Republican just so I can vote, and they're turning to look to the Democrat and the Constitution Party and saying, enough's enough. You guys go ahead and play your little games, but we're moving on.
We just have less than a minute left. I'll give the last word to Ken Verdoya, your best pitch for people to go out and vote today.
Well, I believe that Mark and I have something very similar in interest, that the greatest expression of what this nation represents is when each individual who is legally capable of voting takes the time to go out there and state their case for the future of their nation, their state, and their community by casting a ballot. Now, I don't care whether you vote for Democrat, Republican, Constitution, Martian, or other. I want you to get out there and recognize that this nation is in a tipping point that is determined by your vote. Don't hold off. Don't find an excuse for not participating. Just get out and do it. Primary day, general election day, be involved.
Thank you very much. Ken Verdoya, KUED, and he's part of the effort from public broadcasters. Utah Public Radio is part of this. Vote Utah, and that's voteutah.org.
That is voteutah.org, and the great state site is voteutah.gov, so great resources available online.
And so both of those places, some great resources. You can find your polling place there at either of those sites and get out and vote. Polls open until 8 o'clock tonight. Mark Thomas, Deputy Chief of Staff, Lieutenant Governor, and Director of Elections, has been with us as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we've been talking with Jim Debacus, Utah Democratic Party Chair. Thanks.
Always good to talk with you.
and Kirk Pearson, who is state party chair for the Constitution Party. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you.
And we'll be getting reaction to the results of the primaries on the program tomorrow. Tune in then. Thanks for listening today.
KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KUSU FM HD1 Logan. Thank you for listening to Utah Public Radio. Again, check out our website at upr.org. The time is now 10 o'clock.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.